You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. In this podcast, Dahlia Lithwick recaps the highlights of the last Supreme Court term and gives a brief preview of the term to come. Ms. Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate Magazine and in that capacity writes the Supreme Court dispatches and jurisprudence columns. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and Commentary, among other places. She won a 2013 National Magazine Award for her columns on the Affordable Care Act. She has twice been awarded an Online Journalism Award for her legal commentary and was the first online journalist invited to be on the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press. Ms. Lithwick has testified before Congress about access to justice in the era of the Roberts Court. She has appeared on CNN, ABC, The Colbert Report, and is a frequent guest on The Rachel Maddow Show. Ms. Lithwick earned her BA from Yale University and her JD degree from Stanford. She is currently working on a book about the four women justices of the United States Supreme Court. Dahlia Lithwick spoke at the Wednesday, September 10, 2014 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Grace Zisk. Our podcast is entitled Update on the Supreme Court. Here's Grace Zisk.
Thank you. Actually, I'm going to introduce Dahlia, and then after she speaks, you will all have a chance to ask questions. So that will be the extent of the moderation. Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate, and in that capacity writes the Supreme Court dispatches and jurisprudence columns. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and Commentary, among other places. She won a 2013 National Magazine Award for her columns on the Affordable Care Act. Dahlia has been twice awarded an Online Journalism Award for her legal commentary and was the first online journalist, lost my place, invited to be on the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press. She testified before Congress about access to justice in the era of the Roberts Court. She has appeared on CNN, ABC, The Colbert Report, and is a frequent guest on The Rachel Maddow Show, and she just told me some of you may have seen her on The Jon Stewart Show this past summer, which I'm very sorry I missed. Dahlia earned her BA from Yale University and her JD degree from Stanford. She is currently working on a book about the four women justices of the United States Supreme Court. Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you. I want to thank Bob and Grace for bringing me back. It's been a few years since I've spoken to you, but you all look even better than last time. And I just want to confess to you that what I told Grace is that my son, Sofer, my 9-year-old, was sitting in the green room during Jon Stewart when I was taping, and Jon Stewart walked up to him and said, "You," and he was eating all the candy in the bowl, and he said to my son, "Take everything that isn't bolted to the walls." And so we took all the snacks, all the drinks, everything, a cheese, lovely. So that was my summer. So I want to thank you for having me. I have the unenviable task of telling you everything that happened last term in the Supreme Court, and then in my extra time, everything that's going to happen this term in the Supreme Court. So I may speak a little bit quickly, just because there's a lot of material, with the caveat that I'm going to leave a lot of time for questions. I'll try to talk for about 40 minutes, and if you have questions either about something that was not clear or something, a case that I didn't mention, I'll try to get to it. And I also want to leave time to talk about what I think is the perennially interesting question of why everybody is telling Ruth Bader Ginsburg to retire because she's 81, because I think she's got 22 good years left in her on the bench. And I wonder what you all think of it, because it's been a really interesting conversation. So just three broad themes that I want to offer as, you know, a way of framing the 2013 term at the Supreme Court. And this is my, believe it or not, my 15th year covering the U.S. Supreme Court. So I know every gas station and every sheets on 29 better than I would like to. But that's what I do. I go back and forth to Washington. And just the themes that I want to offer as a way of thinking about the court is, the first one is incrementalism, small steps, that the Roberts Court has really shown that they are going to effect pretty big changes, but they don't do it in one case. They do it in two and three cases. And so this was a year where they could have done a lot, and they did a little in a lot of areas of the law, but they certainly teed up the next case or the case after that for doing a lot. So the court is changing very, very much the doctrine, but doing it in ways that are sometimes significant, sometimes less significant, but always doesn't look to be as much as it is. And so that theme of incrementalism, I think, is a big theme that we saw this year. The other big theme at the term, and this is a word that I coined, so you can take it or leave it, it does not appear in any dictionary, is the word faux-nanimity. So faux-nanimity is fake unanimity, and what it means is that even though at the end of the term there were an enormous raft of 9-0 decisions, they weren't really 9-0 decisions. On most of them, the court agreed on the outcome of the case, and we'll talk about it, but they differed very, very profoundly on both how to get there and where to go next. And so I think there was one theme at the end of the term that said, oh, look at, the court agrees on everything. They're 9-0 on the big cases. I think a lot of that is faux-nanimous, and I urge you to press that word in all conversations. Nina Totenberg used it in her end-of-the-year report and attributed it to some wag. And I was like, dude, I sit right behind you. I'm not some wag. But so the faux-nanimous term. And I think the other thing I want to really highlight is that where the fault lines are at this court, I think it's understood this is a 5-4 court with four progressives and four conservatives and Justice Anthony Kennedy at the center. But the fault lines really deeply lie on issues of culture wars, on identity politics, on race, on gender, on LGBT issues. So this is a court that is actually not terribly split on some issues, but where it is deeply split, and I'm going to read to you from some of the dissents in some of the opinions, is on issues that have to do with identity politics in America. And that's an interesting place to be, but also sometimes quite alarming to see your justices acting very, very grumpy about issues of race and gender, which one likes to think we've sorted out. And the only other thing that I think you should just be aware of as I review the cases is the extent to which the First Amendment speech cases and religion cases have become kind of a giant Pac-Man that swallow doctrine in its wake. And so if you think about the big, big cases of the year, they're not really speech cases, but they're cast as speech cases and they become speech cases. So the cases that look to be about free speech actually determine whether you have to join a union. They determine where and how you can protest, and they determine campaign finance regulations, none of which we would think of as classic speech cases. But a lot of cases that come to the court now come in the posture of a First Amendment speech or religion challenge, and then they decide issues that have enormous ripple effects into doctrine that has nothing to do with speech and religion. So I thought I would start with the blockbuster, which is Hobby Lobby. A word that I had actually never heard until the Supreme Court case. But if you go to Richmond, there is one. And if you're a scrapbooker, maybe you know this. I just didn't know. And Hobby Lobby versus Burwell, which becomes kind of the signature end-of-term case. And I'm going to just briefly tell you what happened. And like I say, if you have questions, you can ask them. Hobby Lobby is a chain of craft stores out of Oklahoma. There are hundreds of stores now, several thousand employees, and under the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, there was a requirement that employers of more than 50 individuals would have to cover preventive health care. in their insurance plans. And the Department of Health and Human Services determined that certain forms of birth control, contraception, come under the rubric of preventive health care. And so there are 20 forms of contraception that have to be covered by employers. The administration tried very carefully to rule out anything that could conceivably be called an abortion-causing drug. And they also ruled out exceptions for, obviously, churches and not-for-profit companies. So if you were a Catholic university or a hospital, the rules were different. You had an exemption. So Hobby Lobby is owned by a family, a very, very devout family in Oklahoma. Conestoga Wood is another plaintiff in the case. This case comes up from Pennsylvania. And they are a cabinet-making company that are Mennonite and also extremely devout, also a family-owned company. Both companies file appeals under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, right? This is not a constitutional case. It's a case that comes up under a statute. And they say, we don't want to cover contraception because there are four devices on the list of 20 that cause abortions, and we can't be a party to causing abortions in our employees. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, very, very briefly, is a law that was passed in 1993 that said that the government cannot, quote, substantially burden a person's exercise of religion. So one of the questions for the court is whether Hobby Lobby, which is a big for-profit corporation, is a person under this statute. And then the other question is whether this is a substantial burden to be asked to pay for what you deem to be an abortifacient, an abortion-causing drug or device. And the court, in a 5-4 decision, you may have heard, a very, very ugly 5-4 decision, said, you know what, this does burden the religious liberties of this company. Under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the government cannot force you to provide your employees with contraception if it violates your religious faith. The court tries to cabin the decision in Hobby Lobby by limiting it to closely held corporations, although it's not entirely clear what that means. And very, very important to Justice Kennedy writing, Justice Alito writing in the case, is that he doesn't think this is going to spread. He says this is a really narrow little case, and it's not going to have, you know, the sort of sky is falling effects that you hear about. And the other thing that's very important to Justice Kennedy is that there is already an exemption in place. Justice Kennedy says, look, you don't have to cover contraception because you've created an exemption for Catholic universities, for hospitals, for the Little Sisters, right, the nuns. All they have to do is fill out a form that says, I object to affording contraception to my employees, and they're exempted. So Alito says this form is the fix. There's an easy fix, and nobody's religious rights are burdened. It probably doesn't bear mentioning, but three of the three women who sit on the court are very upset with this decision, and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, writing for the dissenters, writes a pretty explosive dissent saying, you have no idea what you have just unloosed, not just questions that you've all heard of, can Jehovah's Witnesses deny vaccinations, can you deny AIDS drugs if you don't believe in certain things, but also really, is there no civil rights law that is immune from your employer's vision of that law? And Justice Kennedy writes a concurring opinion basically saying, don't be crazy. Doesn't say it that way, but that's what he says. 4 days later, after the term ends, an order comes down from the court in a case involving Wheaton College, which is a not-for-profit university. And what they're challenging is the fix. They say, we don't want to fill out this form that says that we object to providing abortion-causing drugs, because that also triggers a process that will eventually end in someone getting contraception. And the court says, you're right. That also burdens your religious freedom. So now the fix is the problem. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor writes a dissent for the three women justices. Justice Stephen Breyer does not participate in that dissent. And she writes, those who are bound by our decisions usually believe they can take us at our word. Not so today. In other words, everybody in America relied on the sort of line in the sand drawn in Hobby Lobby, the line just moved. We're going to see those cases that have to do with the not-for-profits, right? This is not the companies and the corporations. Those company cases are also coming up through the court, but we're going to see the not-for-profit cases come to the court very, very soon. And that's going to be an interesting problem. I will say the Obama administration just tweaked the rules to try to make it even easier to be exempted now without even filling out a form. Okay, the other really interesting gender case that came before the court was McCullen versus Coakley. And this was the abortion buffer case that in effect said in 2000, the Massachusetts legislature said women who are trying to access reproductive care clinics can't get in the door because people are shouting at them. There had been some shootings, and they determined that there was simply no way to protect access for women trying to get into clinics. And so they essentially created a buffer, a zone of 35 feet around the entrances to clinics. And they said, this is kind of a zone in which nobody can talk to you. And this comes up to the court as a speech case, obviously, because the protesters say, what are you telling us we can't speak? And the Supreme Court, this is one of those faux-nanimous cases I was telling you about, 9-0. The Supreme Court strikes down the buffer zone in Massachusetts and says, these are not protesters. They are not violent. These are, quote, abortion counselors, and they have a message to offer and that you can't burden their right to do it. So that the bubble falls on First Amendment grounds. One interesting thing about the case is that in dissent, Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, two of the conservative members of the court, say they would go much further. They would do away with, even in Colorado, they have a tiny little bubble that travels with you when you walk into a clinic. Even that's not allowed. People should be able to get right up to you. And the liberal members of the court write nothing. So we actually don't know what the liberal members of the court were thinking. But we know that in Massachusetts, that buffer zone came down. It bears mentioning that there is a buffer zone around the U.S. Supreme Court where you cannot approach anyone and cannot hold a sign. So some gentle counselors are more worthy of First Amendment protections than others. Very, very important to the court in the McCullen decision, all nine members, as I said, sign on, is that we are talking about public sidewalks, thoroughfares, roadways. And they say this is the quintessential place where people in America who can, you know, turn the channel, turn the page, and shut off the computer. There's one place left where we can talk to each other, and that's public sidewalks. I don't know why that word is. I can say phonanimous, and I can't say sidewalk. So that's really essential to the ruling of this case, that we are talking about sidewalks, and that is the last bastion of where people talk to each other. Okay, so Town of Greece. This is another really interesting culture war case. The Town of Greece, not in the Mediterranean, but in upstate New York, has been starting its legislative session, so this is its town council, with a prayer. For many, many years, they had a moment of silence, as most places did, but then they began to find citizen chaplains or chaplains from around the community who would lead a moment of prayer before the legislature met. Why is this a problem? Because for many, many, many years, every single one of the prayers, except for four, were led by Christian leaders, and many, many, many of those leaders were very explicitly saying, you know, because we're all Christians here and we all agree on certain things, and two plaintiffs file suit who feel that they are not Christian and don't agree on those things. One is an atheist and one is a Jewish citizen in Greece, and they say, you shouldn't be in a public space at a public government function allowing sectarian prayer. In this case, goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court has to think about it through the lens of a 1983 prayer case called Kansas versus Marsh. In Kansas versus Marsh, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld legislative prayer, even legislative prayer by a chaplain of one faith, because the Supreme Court said it's old. We've always allowed this. That since the first constitutional convention, we've allowed sectarian prayer before legislative meetings, so we're going to keep allowing it. And so the plaintiffs in Greece say this is different. This isn't the state legislature. And this prayer is not directed at the legislators. This is a town council. This is where people come because they want to petition if they want to move a stoplight or if they want to change a zoning rule. And the prayer is being directed at the audience, not at the legislators. And so we think it's different because we think if we want to go and petition our government, we shouldn't first have to sit through a prayer in which we either have to put our head down or pretend we're putting our head down. You know, we don't sort in this country based on religion. And when you come to petition your government, you shouldn't first go through a kind of religious screening. Supreme Court says no. 5-4, they uphold the town of Greece policy of allowing sectarian prayer, even if it's persistently of only one faith. Justice Kennedy, surprise, surprise, writing for the court, and he says, we've always done this, more or less. It's good because it's old. And as long as, he says, as long as nobody is being, you know, browbeaten or shamed or coerced, as long as non-adherents aren't explicitly made to feel like they don't belong, the prayer is fine. And this is a case, again, where it's almost really interesting to see the dissent. Again, the four dissenters in this case are all Jewish, or a Sotomayor, a lapsed Catholic who sees herself as non-affiliated. And the dissenters, who all see themselves as of minority faiths, sort of say this is a really complicated case if you are of a minority faith, because it's very easy to hear the court say, it doesn't really offend anyone. If you don't like it, close your ears. If you're of a minority faith and you think about what the First Amendment was meant to protect, which is that there is no state-sponsored religion, this feels a little hinky. And Justice Kagan, she doesn't write the word hinky, but she does say in dissent, you know, this is simply not what the framers, when they came to this country and built religious freedom, this is what they were afraid of, that citizens would sit there and feel excluded from by their own government. I should just add that the town of Greece has just updated its prayer policy, creating a prayer policy so bizarre and arcane that it now appears that no one except like two guys in Greece are ever going to be allowed to lead prayer. So I think, and this is a case where I think truly it is safe to say that the Supreme Court has created a lot more problems by solving the problems of Greece than they solved. Okay, the next case is a big affirmative action case called Schuette. And it looks like Schwett, which is how people pronounce it, but it's actually pronounced Schuette. This is a Michigan case that comes up out of the state of Michigan in the wake of the Supreme Court's last big affirmative action case that happened out of Michigan. The voters of Michigan passed by ballot initiative, a measure that got rid of affirmative action it basically said affirmative action is illegal across the state of Michigan for admissions into colleges. And because the voters chose it, it was a very different question from whether it's unconstitutional in a college setting when a college adapts it. This is not, is affirmative action constitutional? It's a ban on affirmative action constitutional. So it's a flip of the affirmative action cases we've seen before. The court decides 6-3, Justice Stephen Breyer, voting with the conservative bloc on the case, that the voters can, in fact, do away with affirmative action in college admissions because the voters chose it. It's different than a university imposing it, which has its own set of issues, but the voters are free, as he says, to have complicated conversations about race, and the voters of Michigan have determined that in Michigan we're not going to have it anymore. It doesn't mean that any other affirmative action program in states where it's legal is affected, but it certainly opens the door to thinking about when that Texas case from 2 years ago about affirmative action comes back to the court, we know where the justices' heads are kind of starting to go on this question. The only reason this is an interesting case, if you loop back to my original point about how identity politics and race and gender are fracturing this court, is the notable dissent by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who is the first Latina justice, who grew up in a housing project and, you know, to a single mom for most of her life, you know, and was on scholarship most of her life, and really felt that as a Puerto Rican life, her life was utterly informed and shaped by race. And she took great umbrage at the language that the Chief Justice used, not in this case, but in a prior affirmative action case where he said, the way to start getting over race is start getting over race. And the way to stop perpetuating racial identity and friction in this country is to just put it past us. And so she writes an 83-page dissent. It's really the first time since her book, I would say, and if you haven't read her biography, it tracks her book quite elegantly. But she basically says, we ain't getting over race. And you can't just by fiat say that we're not having a tough time thinking through our racial problems in this country. And I was going to read to you from her dissent, but I think I'll just say that it's a dissent in which she more or less says, you know, for me and people like me, we're not over race, and we haven't solved the problems of race. And to say that Michigan has decided as a state that race doesn't inflect on every part of your life is to ignore my experience. And I will also add, I've never seen this happen at the Supreme Court. Both Justices Antonin Scalia and Chief Justice Roberts wrote in response to her dissent, saying that they thought she was being inappropriate by sort of both citing to her own experience, but also calling them out for what, you know, she described them as blind. And which is very, very strong language, but they really, really pushed back at her construction of the case. Okay, briefly a few more, and then we'll turn to next term. One important case was about recess appointments, executive recess appointments. This is NLRB versus Noel Canning. Another incredibly interesting case. As you may recall, the President Obama was popping people into positions during recesses that were not really recesses. They were kind of pro forma, brief recesses. Where the Senate was not in session. One of those cases where the court could have gone big. It looked as though the court was going to eviscerate presidential recess powers. They didn't do that. What they did is they cabined and constrained president's recess appointment power. They said, you know, if it's a 20-second recess, it's not a recess. It has to be 10 days, but the president can continue to make recess appointments if it's really a recess. And this was kind of a wash. It looked like a huge big deal, but it reasserted that the president could make recess appointments, but that any games that you were playing to try to block them that really looked like games to try to block them were going to be inappropriate. The other one I want to touch on briefly, and you know, all know about this, is McCutcheon, which is the campaign finance case. And this was basically the exemption that allowed really, 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 really wealthy Americans, like we all are, to aggregate their contributions to many, many, many campaigns so that they didn't, the base limit of $2,600 per candidate is in place. That's still in place from campaign finance reform. But if you want to give to lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of campaigns, you can still do that. It certainly looks like it's a case that has teed up the end of McCain-Feingold. So all of the logic that applies in McCutcheon to people who are aggregating contributions would seem to apply to the next case that comes down the pike saying let's do away even with those base limits. It's also a really interesting case because the language of the Chief Justice, where he more or less says there is no corruption, even the appearance of corruption isn't the appearance of corruption unless it's really a quid pro quo. So unless it looks like I'm giving you money and you are giving my company a plum job, other than that, it's not corruption. And a lot of folks who have looked at these cases, this line of campaign finance cases, say this is one of those areas where you miss a Sandra Day O'Connor, someone who actually sat on a state legislature and knows what happens, and that you don't have to bring in a sack of money like Scrooge McDuck. You know, like it can really just be the appearance of corruption that taints the public's perception that the process is fair. And the very last case I'm going to talk about before I turn to next term, just because I think it's a fascinating counterpoint to my faux-nanimity, I feel like if I say it four times in every speech, it's going to catch on. To my argument about how the court in many of these cases splits but then attacks each other, this is a case where the court was truly unanimous, and that was the Riley, the cell phone case. So this is a case about whether if the police stop your car for genuine probable cause, they have a reason to search you, whether they can search your phone if it's on your car or your person. And up until Riley, mostly the courts treated your cell phone the same way they treated a crumpled up cigarette package on the dashboard, which is anything that's in the car is fair game. And just because we're rooting through your every bit of data that you have, it's no different from flipping through your pockets or your wallets, which you can search. The court, in a really strong, strong opinion written by the Chief Justice, votes 9-0 that your cell phone is different, and that just because the cops can search through your wallet or they can search through your briefcase if it's lying open on the passenger side, they may not, without a warrant, have access to all the data on your phone. And that this really, I think this really shows a major shift of the court into understanding privacy and digital information in a way they had not done before. Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the court, says, quote, "Modern cell phones are so pervasive and insistent part of daily life that the proverbial visitor from Mars might conclude they are an important feature of our human anatomy." And then he goes on to write, saying that the privacy interests here are no different than the interests of privacy you have in your purse or your address book, quote, is like saying a ride on horseback is materially indistinguishable from a flight to the moon. Now, nobody knows exactly what that means, but it was certainly, I think, the best turn of phrase to come out of the court this term. Going forward, I think it really, really telegraphs that the court, the justices who were really relentlessly picked on for not getting it in fundamental ways about how technology has changed our lives, really get it, at least where it comes to cell phones. They really understand that searching your cell phone is more akin to searching every drawer and file in your office than to searching your wallet. So that was a big deal. And I think, by the way, it will burden police in ways that we haven't thought about either. So I just briefly want to highlight what's coming down the pike for next term. And I think the one you all know is coming down the pike is the same-sex marriage cases. We don't exactly know which one is coming, but it seems to me that in 2012, when the court decided United States versus Windsor and the DOMA case, which were the two big gay marriage cases before the court a year and a half ago, they left open really fundamental questions about whether states could ban same-sex marriage. And that question, I think they hoped it would go away for 20 years and they'd all, have retired and some other generation would have to contend with it, but it's back. And we have real splits. Every single court and court of appeals, but two that have looked at same-sex marriage bans in the states have struck them down. So almost every state, using the language, by the way, in that defense of marriage case that said, we don't want to go so far as to strike down same-sex marriage, use it to mean that the court struck down same-sex marriage. In effect, there was a Scalia dissent that said there's no principal difference between striking down the Defense of Marriage Act and striking down state bans. And literally, they take Scalia's dissenting language to stand for the proposition that there is no distinction between those two things. And interestingly, I think this is where Virginia becomes interesting, because it looks as though the Virginia case that the Fourth Circuit decided recently, striking down the ban on same-sex marriage in Virginia, is one of the best candidates to go before the Supreme Court. So we already have splits among the courts of appeals. I think the Virginia case is really interesting because it was argued by Ted Olson and David Boies. You may remember them. They were on opposite sides of Bush versus Gore. They have come together to oppose same-sex marriage in the courts, and they argued the Virginia case. I watched them at the Fourth Circuit. So that's a very, very strong candidate for the case that the court takes. But I really do think, and Justice Ginsburg said the same thing this summer, the court can't duck this issue anymore. And for those of you who want to know how it's going to come down, I would tell you probably what I told you several years ago, which is it all depends on Justice Kennedy. As with so many things, it really depends if he's ready to pull the trigger on this in a way that he was not 2 years ago when he wrote the Windsor case. The other cases that are very, very likely heading to the Supreme Court this coming term, there's two abortion challenges. The court has done a really deft job of not taking an abortion case for many years, but there are two that I think are going to be hard to duck. One has to do with medication abortions, whether the states that are trying to regulate how you prescribe medication abortions, whether those bans are unconstitutional. The other has to do with these admitting privileges statutes that say, and many, many states have passed them, that say that a physician has to have admitting principles at a local hospital or she cannot be an abortion provider. And again, we have a circuit split where the Fifth Circuit in Texas has upheld those laws and said that's important for the health of the woman. The Ninth Circuit has said that's impossible, there's no reason for it, and it precludes, you know, huge numbers of women from accessing clinics. So we're just going to have to see what happens with that. One interesting case that's a follow-on to Hobby Lobby, and watch for it, it's going to be argued in October, is Holt versus Hobbs. This is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, but instead of being applied to Hobby Lobby, it's a prisoner who wants to wear his beard in accordance with his religion and feels very strongly that the prison policy infringes on his religious freedom rights. So we're going to have to see whether the sort of expansive view of religious freedom also applies to minority prisoners. There's a really fascinating First Amendment case that's coming up that has to do with Facebook threats and whether you measure a threat that is made, usually a death threat, that's made on the internet by the intent of the writer or how the reader interprets it. And this can really, really foundationally change our rules about freedom on the internet. And the thing I want to close with, which I think is extremely important, but perhaps not as important as it was a week ago, is the new healthcare challenge to Obamacare. So this should have been coming to the Supreme Court this term. We thought it was. Because the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals has just agreed to rehear it, it may actually not come to the court this year. But this just has to do with the states that did not create state exchanges. There are 34 of them under the ACA Act. All of their insured that got insured on the federal exchange, so now there are millions and millions of people in states that don't have exchanges, use the federal exchange, and this is a challenge, and it really comes down to a drafting question in the Affordable Care Act. This is a challenge to whether the federal government could create a proxy exchange for the states that didn't want to create their own exchanges. And it really does have to do with reading one sentence in that case. The reason it's interesting is because most of the courts that have looked at it have batted away that challenge and said, this is not legitimate. Of course, the federal exchange stands. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal circuit right up the road, upheld the challenge and said, you know what, Obamacare, it does fall on this, and all the states that have insured folks using the federal exchange, those were illegitimate. But just last week, that court withdrew that opinion and agreed to hear it en banc, which means that the whole court will hear it. So now we don't have a split between the courts. We're going to have to wait to see what the D.C. Circuit does. So I think that case gets pushed off till 2015 term, at which point I'll come back and tell you that it's coming down the pike. The very, very last thing I want to say, because I promised I'd say it. Are we okay? Yeah. The very last thing I want to say is that one interesting theme that burbled up this year, in addition to these splits where, you know, all the judges of one religion say one thing and the judges on the other side say you don't get it, and all the judges of one gender say one thing and the justices on the other side say you don't get it, and all the justices on race say one thing. And so I think we're having a really deep, you know, sometimes it looks like a reality show, Supreme Court experiences where people are saying, you don't understand what my life is like. And I found it fascinating this year to see the trope of blindness, you're blind, appearing as often as it did in Supreme Court opinions. I went back and looked, and it's really stunning when you have a bunch of justices calling other justices blind because they don't see what that justice's life was like. I find that quite worrisome at many, many levels. It's something we can talk about, but I think that if I remember correctly, last time I came here, we talked a little bit about empathy, and it seems it's not a failure of sight, but a failure of empathy that is going on, I think, on both sides. And it's really, I think, quite a disturbing mirror image of the failure of empathy that we are experiencing in this country. So I'm going to, having galloped through two terms, I'm going to take a breath and take your questions. And I hope someone asks me if Justice Ginsburg is going to retire.
I'm going to leave the applause. Dahlia, I'm in awe. I'm in awe of you. And I want to say that I hope many of you will have questions, but if you do, please wait until a microphone reaches you. We have one on each side because we podcast this. But I just wanted to start off with one question that I had. With all of this going on, and when we read about it, and some of us are outraged at some of the decisions, is there anything that the average citizen can do to influence a court decision?
What I would caution you not to do is enter the buffer zone around the U.S. Supreme Court. No matter how outraged you are, you will get tackled by a marshal, and he will be huge, so don't do that. Regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, the court is very frustrating because justices have lifetime tenure. And when the framers, you know, framed the Constitution and gave justices and judges, federal judges, lifetime tenure, people live to be, what, like 28? And you didn't get appointed until you were 69, you know, so you're on the court for 8 minutes. And so this was not a concern. You know, two trends we're seeing are that people are appointed younger and younger and younger. And so, you know, the name of the game is to appoint, I swear my 9-year-old is a good candidate, you know, I mean, appoint people who are really, really young and have them sit for 30, 40 years, that's an outsized influence. So I think, you know, structurally, the idea of lifetime tenure doesn't map onto the way we experience life right now. That said, I actually, you know, there are movements out there to create term limits at the Supreme Court, and those are, you know, interesting and worth reading about. But I think the real bare bones issue is that people don't vote on the court. You know, people have a list of the 40 issues that matter to them, and the court is 41. And so if, you know, you think about the fact that the court informs every part of those other issues, right? Whether it's the environment or campaign finance or whatever it is, race, education, the court is changing the landscape, and we're not looking at it. So I think, I don't know if it's because it's too attenuated, it's too hard to think, oh, you know, I care about X and the court has determined X, so therefore I should care, but people just don't. And so I think one thing is to just be informed and aware of what the courts are doing, and that when you vote, you know, be aware and to, you know, let your senators and congresspeople know that this matters to you. But I do think that there is sort of, in good and bad ways, an idea that, you know, once you put on that black robe and you take up residence in front of that red curtain, you're magic, you know, and we have the most mystified, oracular court. It's quite amazing in a democracy, right down to not letting cameras in there, certainly not podcasting, you know, and I think that the court is utterly insulated. And sometimes that's good, right? Brown versus Board of Education. And sometimes it's not good. But I think that you have to understand that these are people too, that confirmations matter, that you need to really care either way, because it's a hugely consequential thing that doesn't happen with magic people by magic, but happens through constitutional and democratic processes that we control. Okay, questions?
Dahlia, is Ruth Ginsburg going to retire?
Wow. You totally read my mind. So just by way, thank you. Just by way of background, Ruth Ginsburg is 81 years old. She's a two-time cancer survivor. When people come to the court, the first thing they say is, "Oh my God, she looks so frail." But I remind them that she has looked like this since she was 20. She's not a robust human. She's just very, very thin, and she takes little mincing steps. And so people see her and they get this notion that, she's infirm in some way. And I can certainly tell you, I see no difference in her performance on the bench this year than 5 years ago, than 10 years ago. So I don't see that she's failing. But I think there has been a very, very concerted effort on the part of liberals, particularly liberal academics, including someone like Erwin Chemerinsky, you know, really one of the fathers of the left constitutional thinkers, who says she needs to step down this second so that Obama can replace her because she's 81 and the, you know, court stands in the balance. She has made clear in every interview in which she is asked whether she plans to retire, like short of punching the interviewer in the mouth, she is not going anywhere. Now, there's a sort of normative question, which is, should she retire? She's determined she's not going to. You know, my feeling is, you know, Justice Stevens stayed on till he was 87. He could still be on the court today, in my view. I think he actually retired too early. And I realize this sounds a little strange in light of what I just said about justices living forever. But I think that, there's this question of gaming the presidential elections that is incredibly inappropriate when you're talking about the court, that justices can't and shouldn't take that into account. And if they do take it into account, it should be between them and their priest. I mean, this is not a national conversation we should be having about pressuring people to leave the court before they're ready. And in the most granular way, I think I would also just say that she watched, you know, and this is just the gossip part of the show, but she watched Sandra Day O'Connor retire too early. And that was her closest colleague on the court. And O'Connor stepped down, as you may recall, because her husband was dying and she wanted to be able to take care of him. And Chief Justice Rehnquist at the time, who was dying of thyroid cancer, said to her, "We can't have two retirements in 1 year. You go this year, I'll go next year, and that way there'll be one summer instead of two summers with confirmation hearings." And she agonized about it. She felt that she wanted to hang on another year. By the time they'd had that conversation, she'd booked all her speeches. She'd hired her clerk. She wanted to be at the court for one more year. She said, "All right, Chief, if you say I'm going now, I'm going now." She stepped down. Chief died within a few weeks. We had our two vacancies the same summer. And by that winter, John O'Connor, her husband, was institutionalized. And by a year later, he had a girlfriend at his nursing home because he didn't remember his wife, which is all just a long, sad way of saying, you know, she retired before she needed to. And watching that happen, right or wrong, I think very much influences Justice Ginsburg's thinking of not getting pushed off before it's your time. And I think the worst thing people can do if they want her to retire is to try to push her off.
I've been receiving emails lately about a constitutional amendment to reverse Citizens United. And I wonder if you have some thoughts on what could happen in that context and whether that amendment would have unanticipated consequences.
I like the second half of the question, what the unanticipated consequences are. I mean, I think there has been several groups doing really interesting work trying to reverse Citizens United. And I think that amending the Constitution is really, really, really hard. And there's a reason we haven't passed the ERA yet. You know, I mean, we can't seem to do it in this country, and we certainly can't do it in this political climate. So I think there are really interesting people leading very, very interesting initiatives. I don't think Citizens United probably gets fixed by way of constitutional amendment. I think it gets fixed by a change in the composition of the court. Because I think that there are certainly four justices who think that it was absolutely wrongly decided. And I think that they tried to take a Montana case a few years ago that would have allowed them to re-examine Citizens United, and they couldn't get the votes to take it. But I do think that there is a feeling, at least on one portion of the court, that the reasoning in Citizens United was very naive, and that if the justices thought, and this I guess comes down to Justice Kennedy again, thought a little bit harder about what they had unloosed, they might change their minds. Now, I don't think any of the five justices in the majority of Citizens United are going to change their minds, but I do think that the court is, you know, depending on the composition of the court, could be open to rethinking or cabining campaign finance, the cases that have happened. The other thing that's just sort of interesting about Citizens United is more and more I feel like in some ways it becomes obsolete just because the electorate has become, it's like the damage is done. The electorate is so cynical and so angry. And they experience commercials in a way that has such a backlash that if you looked at the 2012 election, commercials made almost no difference. Multi-billion dollar campaigns had no effect because A, I think people have become so soured on the process, and B, because they've just learned that, you know, their electorate is bought and sold. Now, that is not good news. I don't, you know, suggest that a cynical electorate is a good one. But I think that one of the lessons I've taken from the huge influx of big money into campaigns is that already we're seeing diminishing return. It's not working as well as it once did. And, you know, that's depressing because it means we broke our citizenry. But I think that it is certainly possible going forward that big money into campaigns has less and less effect. You have to pour more and more money in to get the same effects, and that people still respond in really negative ways to it. That's not happy news, but I think that at least while the composition of the court stays the same, not only is Citizen United still good law, and now McCutcheon is good law, but I think they've teed up the base limit, doing away with base limits. So that's one of those issues on which I think that who's on the court matters an awful lot.
The court recently agreed to hear a case involving redistricting of the Alabama legislature. How are they going to decide that?
Oh, God, I don't know. And I confess that I haven't drilled down on that. But the redistricting cases are horrible. I mean, they are such a mess. And this is another case where the court has created doctrine that has created more problems than it's solved. And redistricting is another one of those areas where O'Connor's world, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor sort of wrote the seminal redistricting cases. And now that she's gone, you know, everything she wrote kind of stands for nothing. But those redistricting cases are, you know, each and every one of them is like a migraine in a bottle. They're just, you know, the doctrine is a complete mess. And so I think both redistricting and voting rights, those cases that were sort of seminal O'Connor doctrine have crumbled, and then it's just a case of how the Supreme Court creates another bad test to substitute for the bad tests they have there. You know, the Texas redistricting case is incomprehensible. So I don't know how it's going to come down, but I know that whole area of doctrine is like going down a, you know, wormhole of increasingly unfathomable and impractical doctrine. So it's not a great answer, but do I think they're going to fix things? No.
Thank you. There was a recent editorial written by one of your colleagues on the front page of the New York Times, Mr. Litvak, that contended that some of the briefs that had been submitted to the court to assist them or guide them in their decision-making process relied on information that was less than accurate, and that was subsequently adopted by the court in decisions anyways. Could you talk to that, please?
Yeah, I mean, that was in my business. So this was Adam Liptak wrote this 2 weeks ago, a piece in the Times that, based on a law review article that went and ferreted out places where things were asserted as facts in opinions that were either just in a brief without any background or attribution, or were simply wrong, and they get baked into the opinion as fact. And the person who wrote this Law Review article had several really alarming examples of the court asserting that something was true and there's no foundation for that assertion. And his point was they just make up facts. And I think there's a few things to be said about it. The first is that that's really terrifying, that, you know, the court relies on these amicus briefs, and the amicus briefs are supposed to be thorough and well-researched, and people are just throwing some garbage in, and the court kind of cuts and pastes the garbage and puts it in the opinion, and now it's not just in an opinion, it's the law. So that's a huge and terrifying proposition. I think that the other thing, and I thought about writing this piece and I didn't, because I'm lazy, but the reason that this is a really huge problem is because the court used to get 3 or 4 amicus briefs in a case, and now they can get 40 and 50 of them. And the opinions that used to be 7 or 8 pages can be 280 pages. So I think this is part of the expanding, you know, the endless expansive doctrine that, you know, things that Brown was a page, right? Brown was written so that it could be on the front page of every newspaper in the country. And now we have opinions that are 300 pages with footnotes, with thousands of citations, and even more alarming, if you put that in tandem with another piece that Adam Liptak did a few months ago, when the court makes mistakes, you know how they correct them? In secret. They don't have a correction policy with a line that says, you remember that inaccurate fact we put in? They simply change it. There's no record of, I mean, when I make a mistake at Slate, I have to correct it. There's a note forever with an asterisk at the bottom of the piece. The court doesn't have a corrections policy. And so, for instance, this year, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion with a glaring error in it. And when it comes out in the books, it will be fixed. And nowhere will there be a record that there was a mistake, and some things get fixed years later. So the court has this kind of backdoor policy to fixing its errors, and that, in tandem with the fact that it's making errors, I think is doubly horrifying. But I think the big, big part of it is that, and this I attribute a little bit with all due respect to academics and recovering academics in the room, is, you know, that justices used to be state legislators, and they used to be, you know, lawyers that worked in government, and now half of them are academics, half of them are judges, and I really think that the ethos at the court is, why say in 40, you know, pages what you can say in 240 pages? And so you really increase the chance of making horrific mistakes. And so I think, you know, my short answer to my long answer is that this is part of just a large, large trend at the court to complicate and obfuscate and to hide behind a lot of words and a lot of footnotes and a lot of, you know, well, I didn't say it because it was in one of 42 amicus briefs. But I think it's just a part of trying to be both oracular and perfect and too complicated. And then I think that the, you know, lack of transparency, which is its whole other problem. I mean, I cannot believe we don't have cameras at the Supreme Court. I cannot believe we don't have same-day audio at the Supreme Court. I cannot believe that until about 5 years ago, if any of you walked in to watch an oral argument, you would not have been allowed to take in a pen and a paper, because the court does not want scrutiny, but you can't not want scrutiny and also make mistakes. And I think both those things are happening, and I find it quite scary. So I don't know if that's fully responsive, but it's a problem.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but as an attorney, isn't the altering of public records a felony?
Well, you know, it's a good point. As I say, don't go within 35 feet of the court and say that. I think they would say they're not altering public records. What they're doing is, you know, correcting drafts that come out after. I'm sure there's a plausible reason for their corrections policy. And, you know, they do say, and this is, you know, I'm being hard on them. What they say is that when they hand out, you know, if you're there for a hand down day, when decisions come down the court, they hand you what's called a slip opinion. And it's a little, you know, tiny piece of paper. It's this big, and it's the whole opinion, and it's been rushed. And it says at the top, you know, this is not for final, you know, publication and review. In other words, they have plausible deniability. They can say, you know, we gave you a quickie draft, and of course it had mistakes. Now, query whether that means you can go 7 years and correct something. But I do think that, you know, their feeling is, on many, many of these issues, their feeling is, we're trying to help you, by giving you a quick and dirty draft, you know, don't complain if we fix it. That would be the argument. And I find, you know, most of, you know, when we complain, for instance, as you may recall, when the healthcare cases came down and, you know, we got a stack of, you know, the opinion was this big and several people, including Wolf Blitzer, read the wrong decision. You remember they got on the air and they were like, the ACA is struck down. And then, you know, there's this, you know, people got fired, and within 5 minutes it was corrected. But when you go back to the court, to the public information office, and you say, how could you, you know, not just give us one paragraph? We're all going to be on Twitter, right? Because it's 2013 or 2012. Give us one paragraph so we can get it right. And the argument really is, why don't you just take a week and read it? You know, like, you have time. I don't understand why you need to, you know, there's any imperative to be quick. And Chief Justice Rehnquist, and I can end with this, Chief Justice Rehnquist, at one point, Linda Greenhouse, who was Adam Liptak's predecessor at the New York Times, went to him on behalf of all of us in the press corps, and she was sort of the dean of the press corps with tremendous gravitas, which I lack. And she said to him, you know, Chief Justice Rehnquist, it's kind of crazy on the last day of June when you hand us four decisions and we have to write them up for our papers and they're each, you know, 120 words. Is there any way you could space them out over a week or over the last 2 weeks of the term so it isn't nuts because we make mistakes? And bless his soul, his answer was, why don't you just report some of them on Monday and some of them tomorrow? I mean, he really was like, what is this news you talk of? You know, like, it's not my problem if you know, you could just report some of them in May. What's the problem? So I think, you know, part of the larger conversation that the court is failing to have with the nation, not just the press, with the nation, is that things that worked really, really well in 1857 in that media climate don't work so well now. And the court, as you may or may not know, every justice has a computer and they write to each other on white paper. So thank you very much for having me, and have a good
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.